Grab your highlighters. Can't find them? They're probably right there in your pocket protector. It's time for that Early Childhood Nerd Podcast. Let's get nerdy. Here's Heather.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of That Early Childhood Nerd. I'm Heather Berntsanti. Very, very, very excited to have Stephanie Galloway joining me today. Hi, Stephanie.
Hey, Heather.
Hi. Before I let you tell people about yourself, I just have to say how much I enjoyed getting to know you at NACI and like those rocking chair conversations. What a great idea for NACI to have all those rocking chairs out in the hallways and spaces, because I feel like we got to know each other so well, just sitting there rocking and talking about resilience.
Could have been a front porch for all we knew.
Right? Yeah. So I'm just really glad to be looking at you again and be talking with you. So what do you want people to know about you before we jump into our conversation?
Well, I am a lifer in the early childhood field. I have had my first childcare center on my back porch when I was 9 years old. One of those kids who wanted to be a teacher from the time they were like in preschool themselves. Mm-hmm. And in spite of that clear definition of what it was that I wanted to do when I grew up, I did a lot of circles and spirals around what I wanted to do. I certainly have spent a long time in childcare, in preschools. I was a director, early intervention. I taught elementary school. I worked with adjudicated teens.
I've done that. Wow.
Library. I was a children's librarian or an assistant because I didn't have the right degree. Mm-hmm. A storyteller. And ended up teaching community college for over 20 years in two different community colleges in Pennsylvania. And I guess I say all that because mostly what I believe in is development. Mm-hmm. And I followed my strong curiosity and wonder about development, and wherever it led me, that's where I wanted to be at that moment. Yeah. So I, it kind of took me in a lot of really interesting places. And the other thing that's been kind of a constant in my life is my love of fairy tales, mm-hmm. and the imagination. And so that's how I got to where I am right now.
Yeah. Great segue, because you're here. It's like you had this plan. So you wrote a book that's called Happily Ever Resilient, Using Fairy Tales to Nurture Children Through Adversity. That's what we're going to talk about. But I think this is, when I say we had those rocking chair conversations about resilience, I think you had heard me express frustration with the way resilience is being thrown around. And so that was a starting point for us. So just to clarify, I think, you know, I've loved reading this book. It's wonderful. I can't wait for people to hear you and to get the book. But my frustration is not about the idea that we need to build resilience or help children foster that. It's that people just see it as, oh, they are resilient. They already are resilient. So it doesn't matter what we throw at them, they're going to be fine. And, you know, we heard it a lot at the end of, well, the end of the major part of COVID. We're not quite at the end, but where people didn't really want to talk about what children needed because they're resilient. And so I think this is really important, this conversation to have now.
I agree. I think the more I think about resilience, and I certainly talk about it a lot more, but your comment did, I mean, I remember the exact moment I was driving back.
So I can't listen to early childhood podcasts in my car. I can't do it.
I was safe. Yeah, but I think that it's really good to hear different opinions. And I've been gathering like the people who have said, I'm not sure about resilience for other reasons as well.
Oh,
and I think that, I mean, it's kind of all clumped into this. It's a big generalization type of word, and it's used by everybody. But I've started to think about it. Like, I mean, we don't say children young children, I mean, we do say that they talk, but we say there's a developmental process behind that.
Right.
There's a developmental process behind everything that all of us do. And I think that's what I really believe we need to start thinking about with resilience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I think it's kind of like if we said, well, children can be healthy. Yeah. Yeah, they can. There's things we do that contribute negatively or positively or sort of, you know, but it's not just something that they spring into life fully having, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think,
or that
I think,
it can't be changed by by the circumstances.
Absolutely. I mean, I think in taking it from a neurodevelopmental point of view, which is what current researchers are doing, mm-hmm. really takes it off of the plate of everybody had like only really like special people have it or everybody has it. It's actually, it's like, sure, the vast majority of people do learn how to talk, but there's a really wide continuum depending on many, many different factors on how you talk, how fluently you mm-hmm. talk, what kind of vocabulary you use, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's an important, I believe that that's what's important to really start wrestling with the term resilience as well.
Yeah. So I'm going to go ahead and read the quote, cause I have to, it's in, you know, it's in the rules. This is just from very early in your book, page 2, but you wrote, "We can transform our best practices surrounding play stories and nurturing relationships into the protective factors for resilience, which are attachment, initiative, self-regulation, and cultural affirmation." So I want to let you talk just a little bit about that. And then I want you to talk about the book as a whole and like what it, how, what you do with it and how it contributes to resilience.
Okay. The quote that you read was my big aha moment. I came to study resilience because I went back at age 59 to get my doctorate, and
don't tell me that. I just at 53 decided I don't need it. Okay.
Well, I had to.
Yeah, go ahead.
But then, honestly, what happened was my husband passed away from substance use disorders, and I'd learned a lot about the impact of substance use disorders on me as an adult, and who was like didn't it was a family disease. After he passed, and on kids, mm-hmm. and I realized I'd never had any professional development about it. And so I went back to get my doctorate because I did not have the self-discipline to learn what I wanted to learn about what teachers really might find useful in working with substance use disorder. So that was my like spiral. I did not plan. I mean, I always thought, I'll get my doctorate, but I never, you know, like after 50, I was like, But I had a real burning interest in trying to figure out what it was that would, it was there anything that teachers could be doing or that kids could do with children that would support them who, if they were living with parents with substance use disorders. Mm-hmm. So that was my, like, how it got there.
Yeah.
And in the process of my research and all the coursework and everything, I hit upon resilience. And I was like, I thought, oh, well, this is good. This is positive. It's not just everything's so sad, all the research on trauma and substance use disorders and all that. So here is like, oh, I like this. This is a good one. And the more I dug into resilience and specific models of resilience and the research on resilience, one, it is a primary protective factor to help people who have been exposed to ACEs, including substance use disorder, to not, for substance use disorders, there's a genetic, a pretty strong genetic component. Mm-hmm. They found that this resilience was actually a neurodevelopmental way that could offset the trajectory and had positive outcomes once somebody got older. So that was all very positive and good.
Yeah.
But then I really dug into it. And I was like, oh, these protective factors play. Like all of the good things that we know about child development are what you need to develop this resilience.
Okay.
And we know that as much as we understand about how important play and choice and like wonderful loose parts, all of the discovery and nature and all of the good things are, it's not happening as much as we want.
Right.
And I've been in the field for like, you know, over 50 years. And I mean, I've never had a calendar time with a preschooler. It's because in the 1970s, we knew that that was stupid. And so what is it that we are, have missed? And I thought, okay, maybe there's a way that if what we know about child development is what Ann Masten called the ordinary magic of resilience. I mean, she said there's nothing exceptional. There's no special program that you have to put into place. It's just these relationships and attachment. It's giving kids and it letting them be, have initiative and agency. It's discovery. It's all executive function, self-regulation and cultural affirmation. The things that are part, like they are pretty much the pillars of developmentally appropriate practice. Maybe this is a different frame to offer people to rethink their practices.
Yeah.
That it, and it becomes a both and instead of an either or.
Yeah.
Social, emotional, or early academics. It's like resilience to me is the biggest umbrella that we honestly, for me, it encompasses everything, but it's also there. I really don't think that there's anything more important than preparing us to face challenges in life.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's always stuff to learn, right? I'm not here, obviously, as that early childhood nerd to say, y'all don't have to learn anything anymore because just play makes it all happen and it's magic. But I do think that that's a barrier with some conversations about resilience because, you know, a teacher in an early childhood classroom or someone who's doing childcare at home in their home, and they hear this idea about protective factors and resilience, and they think they need some sort of certification to start, you know, to start understanding it. But what I heard you talking about there, and what I got a lot from a lot of this in the book is we can learn as we go, but we can still start. Like there's a starting point now. If we don't have to feel like we can't work with children's trauma until we're perfect and we've achieved this standard of certification or something like that.
Right. And I got into it quite a bit with colleagues of mine when I started to get into this work, because they're like especially the people who were in social work, they were like, excuse me, trauma and substance use disorders are our field.
Right.
And I was like, yeah, but you know what? Early childhood people are with these children 8 to 10 to 12 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And you don't have time. Like you don't have time to do all this. And that's what I think Dr. Masten's work on resilience to me was so affirming, because everybody needs resilience. I look back at my childhood and I had all of the protective factors of resilience. And I had a very non-traumatic childhood. But I've had an extremely traumatic adulthood. And it's because of that core of resilience, because that I've been able to bounce back. And instead of being curled up in a little ball someplace, I'm you know, I wrote a book. I went back for my doctorate. I wrote a book. I'm still curious. I love to learn and keep growing. So I really think that to me, that was the other big thing that I hope to accomplish through my research, through getting the word out there, is that creating an environment to develop resilience is not just for kids who have experienced trauma. For one thing, we often don't know who these kids are.
Right.
You might know some of them, but chances are one in four kids lives in a home impacted by substance use disorders. I mean, that's a lot. Yep. And you don't necessarily know those kids, but you also, all kids, even if they are in an ideal situation and have no trauma or no big challenges right now, they need to develop resilience, because that's what their brain is going to need as they adapt to all the changes.
Right. It's like, you know, they're like, what was I just going to say? When I talk about inclusion or practices around belonging, it benefits everybody in the space. It's not just for that person, that child, that person, whoever, who, you know, is disabled or whatever. And I think about this the same way whenever, and I, that's why I like that some people are shifting their language from trauma responsive to trauma informed, because we don't have to wait to see it to respond. We can learn about these resiliency, protective factors and resilience, and just do it for everybody.
Yes. And that to me is, I mean, the more I learned about the all of the neuroscience behind it and what it actually involved and connected it with all the dots of everything I knew about child development, it was okay. So this is an umbrella that all teachers should be using in their classrooms for all kids. And how do you and it also incorporates much of what we're already doing. And I think to me, it's not so much doing things that are very different for many of us.
Right.
It's just kind of like turning the kaleidoscope a little bit so that your lens is focused on, okay, yes, I'm hugging this child because that's what I do.
Yeah.
I'm also nurturing their resilience because they need this attachment. They need this connection. And that's part of resilience too.
Yeah. 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 I remember when I was working with, it was school age and teenagers who had a lot of trauma in their life. It was just we were just a drop-in community center. They'd come play basketball and hang out with our adult staff and stuff. And I would have dreams that there would be babies crying that I couldn't find. And I called my friend Jenny, who's my dream person, finally. And I was like, "What is happening?" And she said, "I can't believe you don't just know this. There are needs around you every day that are big that you feel like you can't meet." And she did, she broke it down. She's like, "But the relationships that you form and just being that safe space, like you can't maybe fix all of those big things, but you're making a difference in all of those consistent everyday, you know, play and relationships and all that kind of stuff." And so I thought about that too, while I was reading this, that a lot of times too, it feels so daunting. Mm-hmm. We can't solve all these problems.
Right. And I mean, I certainly, like, back when I was working with teenagers and other and even younger children and kids, all kids, there have always been those kids that I couldn't quite figure out. And looking back, I'm thinking, gosh, if you'd known that, knew that that this child had trauma. I've had kids who I worked with in elementary school. I've become friends with on Facebook. It's 20s and 30s. And they're like, "Yeah, I don't know if you knew this, but you know, like this was going on in my home when I was in your class." And I'm like, "Oh my God, if had I known." And they said, "No, it doesn't matter that you are not. It's that relationship. You opened your heart. You were that person who I knew was always going to be there, that you were always going to tell the stories and play and have fun with me. And it was a safe space." And so I think we've got to recognize that we're not, if you're not going to necessarily be that the person that's going to save that child's life, but
you
can do a lot of things that help all kids.
So there were three things in the quote. You talked about play, stories, and nurturing relationships, and I'm gonna go mix them up a little bit. We kind of talked about play. We're digging into relationships now, but what kinds of things? How do I want to ask this? So whenever I talk to groups of people, whether it's doing a workshop or teaching at the college, when I talk about relationship building and attachment, it's really difficult to move them past, "Well, they all love me. They all are happy. You know, they give me hugs, whatever." But we're talking about something a little bit more intentional. Like, that's great. But how do you describe the intentional relationship building that would impact these protective factors?
I mean, that's a great question. And that's, honestly, for one thing, I think it may look a little bit different for different people. Different caregivers will have different ways of that. But to me, it's about listening to the kids and respecting them. I mean, you know, like I respected every child, every teen I ever worked with as an individual. I tried to get to know them, listen to them, hear their stories. Not push my own agenda onto them, because to me that reciprocity is something that is sometimes for really little kids, I mean, they don't talk back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
so, Yeah. There's that stream going out from you.
Uh-huh.
And to me, it's that reciprocal relationships are really what it's all about.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean I give you love, you give me love. It's like, I ask a question and I listen to what you say. Yeah. And then we figure out what we're going to do about discovering how we're going to play, or yeah, what that worm is doing on the
yeah, I think it goes back to play, because when children are playing, it's like we're sort of listening to them when they can't verbally tell us about themselves yet. They're telling us a lot through their play that we can use to connect, even if their play isn't necessarily telling you home is really messy right now. And I want to throw in here too that home's not the only place these children experience trauma. Sometimes it's in our programs and sometimes it's in school.
Yeah.
They may not be able to say that or play in a way that explicitly shows you that, but there's something you can see in their play to use to connect mm-hmm. with them.
I found and if you listen, they'll tell you. I worked with a little boy when I was teaching first grade, who is probably the most obvious child I've ever worked with who had experienced trauma.
Mm-hmm.
He's in a foster home. He did things like put rubber bands around his neck. Mm-hmm. I mean, very, very interesting child. And I just, you know, I always had books out, I had stuff out, and he grabbed Rapunzel one day mm-hmm. and he goes, read me this book. And I was like, 6-year-old boy, Rapunzel. And it
right.
was like floofy, like Paul Zielinski's beautiful mm-hmm. Castle-y one. And so I read it to him and he was like, I want to make me a braid. And I was like, okay, well, like, let's look around. What could you find that you could make a braid out of?
Uh-huh.
And the paper and the scissors, and he made it and he taped it on the back of his head.
Wow.
Braid, and went through that. And he was, now I want to make that tower. And like, we recreated our whole, and I brought out everybody. I mean, the kids knew he was a little different.
Mm-hmm.
We brought the entire group in, and I was like, hey, Albert wants to make a tower. Anybody got any ideas? And we did this thing, mm-hmm. and it was first grade. So I was like, tower.
Yeah. Throw in all those things that make it acceptable to the outsiders.
And I was like, this is actually phonics. It looks like we're creating like a huge tower on our wall.
It looks like joy is happening, but don't worry.
Don't worry. We got that little stuff in there. But this, I mean, it was transformational.
Wow.
And the child like came out. He quit, like took the rubber bands. It took yeah. weeks, but all the kids were fascinated. He became the leader. I mean, mm-hmm. this whole wonderful, like the things that we all like, we love to see happen yeah. with groups of children all came out of it. But it was because I had kept my mouth shut and listened and recognized that, you know, this, he wanted this random story read mm-hmm. that like it yeah. didn't make sense to me
yeah.
But I respected it, and I respected that he could take his own initiative, and he can, and all of those protective factors for resilience
mm-hmm.
And including that cultural affirmation, because I think that's something we often forget mm-hmm. is we're not just talking about kids' culture with a capital C, we're talking about what the culture is within our classroom
mm-hmm.
and how we build those connections and feeling like, I mean, they were all like, some of the kids that I've spoken with who were in that class, like actually remembered building that tower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Like 20 years later.
You know, with the best of intentions, at one point in, you know, in my career, I could see this happening. I would have brought in books that had foster families or things like that and include that, you know, have that representation. But by letting him choose the book, it was much more like powerful. Like I think about the hubris of me as an early teacher thinking that I could guess what was going to be relevant and meaningful and connect for children instead of letting them tell me.
Right. And that's, you know, I think that that's, I mean, I actually found out for this particular child, as part of his punishment in his birth family, he had been like strapped to a chair in a pickup truck and had to watch all the other kids play outside.
Oh,
I mean,
my gosh.
Like, ooh.
Yeah,
but that, how would I have ever known that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I didn't. And I think that that's what to me is so important about our relationships, is honoring and respecting these children as incredibly interesting, wonderful humans who are trying figure out how to be a human being in a world that I have a hard time after 70 years figuring out how to be a human being in.
Yeah.
They're so listen to them. They are so wise, and I think we if we listen to their play, we watch their play, we don't butt in, we don't try to smoosh them into boxes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think my other frustration with the conversation about resilience and social emotional learning and all of this is, again, not that it's not necessary and important, but the children who are showing us their trauma are seen as disruptions, and we want the resilience information so that we can stop the disruption and continue along our way, instead of saying, oh, maybe we need to be disrupted. Maybe I, as a teacher, need to be disrupted in this way so that I can be what this child needs, and the other children who aren't showing me the need can benefit from that too.
Yeah, no, I think I absolutely. I mean, I was the first teacher, the only first grade teacher in my school when they said we're going to do inclusion. My principal asked for volunteers, and I was like, it was right before IDEA happened. Uh-huh. There was one teacher in every grade level who volunteered. I had six in first mm-hmm. grade. And that's what I found, was that it was so beneficial for all the kids. Mm-hmm. And
that's again, the show.
I respected all
now
of,
go get your nerd on.
Yeah. Yeah.
They all have things to learn and to grow from, and to never had a bunch of little faces on popsicle sticks that I could hold up and like, who's happy today? Because we talked about happiness, and then we talked about sadness. And I encouraged them to communicate with each other from, I just fell into a lot of early childhood experiences mm-hmm. that helped me to learn how to help kids be in relationship, not only with me, but also with each other, which is another part of that resilience model that I really think is important to remember, is it's not just us.
Yeah.
It's the other kids. That peer relationships are also a protective factor, mm-hmm. and it's something that we sometimes, I mean, obviously play is where that is rich.
Right.
And so when we're encouraging children to play by themselves and solve their own problems and giving them the tools to do that, that's also promoting resilience for all children.
Yeah. Yeah. So then the third thing that you had in that list is stories, and that kind of leads us back to the book specifically. You use nursery rhyme, no, fairy tales. Sorry. I was talking about nursery rhymes a couple days ago. You use fairy tales as like, a model for how stories can be used in this way. So talk about that a little bit.
Okay. So, I've always been fascinated with fairy tales. I actually did my master's, thesis on fairy tales and social and emotional development, socio-moral development. And so I had that foundation, and, truth in story. Mm-hmm. When it came time for me to do my dissertation, I wanted to do it on resilience, and they booted back my prospectus and said that I needed to work on it, and I got irritated.
Because, oh boy.
Because I was like, I'm 62 years old and I'm a snot.
Yeah. And let me tell you,
I know what I'm doing. As I was ranting and thinking about giving up the program.
We're such kindred spirits.
I've already learned what I wanted to learn.
Yeah. How dare you? Anyway.
A friend of mine said, what are you passionate about? This is going to be a long slog, and you're going to need to pick something that you're passionate about. And resilience is obviously it, except mm-hmm. for what? Yeah. And I was like, well, I like fairy tales. And he said, well, I mean, could you do something on fairy tales? Mm-hmm. And when I started to look at fairy tales and think about fairy tales, I knew that developmentally they really did. They matched children's cognitive and social and emotional development. That I'd found that out through my previous work. Mm-hmm. And I thought, but wait a minute, fairy tales, resilience, they're all about overcoming the dragon or whatever mm-hmm. it is. And that is what resilience is. So I thought, let me actually look at fairy tales from all over the world and see if they have these specific protective factors in them. And in fact, I found that they did. I did a descriptive content analysis and blah, 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 blah. And it turned out my data was really good, which is, I could have probably said that without doing the study, but it was really fun.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah. So I think, and the, when I say that, I think children's play comes from lots of different sources, but it comes from stories. Mm-hmm. And it comes from, often when we see their make-believe play, it comes from the stories that they see on TV. It comes from books that we read. It comes from, you know, like mm-hmm. things that they experience in their houses, wherever. It's all about story. And to me, it's important that we share kids stories that really are about resilience, about overcoming obstacles. Mm-hmm. And a lot of children's literature that is coming out, and it seems like we're really tipping so far to the, you know, it's like, I am happy.
Yeah.
Like, let's find out how to be happy. And uh-huh. like, Jimmy has a problem. Let's solve the problem. And to me, those are not stories. Those are like news reports.
Right. It's propaganda.
And I don't think that, I think, again, getting back to the respect that I have for children and for their intelligence and uh-huh. for their ability to see through a lot of BS, I think a lot of those books that we like, and mm-hmm. there's some very popular books that I just am like, they're not good stories.
Right.
And fairy tales and folk tales have been around for hundreds, many of them thousands of years, mm-hmm. and have been retold by every culture in the world in different ways. And to me, that core, when we talk about, you know, like you and I've talked a little bit about representational schema, story mm-hmm. schema.
Yeah.
They are the pared down, they are a way for kids to understand what a story is, and they offer resilience and generic stock characters that kids can identify with on many different levels. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that I would kind of combine it all. And I think, and they're also hard to find in a lot of early childhood classrooms.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. I found out, you know, a year or a couple years ago in one of my classes that my students didn't know who Mother Goose, what I was talking about when I said Mother Goose. And then fairy tales, they knew like the ones that had Disney versions, but otherwise they weren't familiar with like the real story. You know, I started thinking about classrooms I've been in, and unless it was that commercialized, you know, can't think of the publisher anyway, story, they weren't there. But you kind of address in the book that there are some folks who think that we should ignore fairy tales because of, you know, what they see as problematic messages.
Absolutely. I think that's not new. Mm-hmm. Like that I started seeing like big backlash about that even in the 70s and mm-hmm. then 80s, and then it kind of receded, and now and I mean, I think people think that, I mean, there's, you know, sexism, there's ageism, there is consent, you know, mm-hmm. yes, yeah. you know, like all yeah. this stuff. And what my understanding, I mean, those are all, I mean, you know,
important things to think about.
We don't want to like expose kids to ideas that are going to destroy them. But to me, I think one of the problems, and I've thought this for a very long time, with adults understanding or objections to fairy tales, is that mm-hmm. adults are looking at them through adult eyes. Mm-hmm. And young children do not have the same cognitive frameworks that we do. Mm-hmm. And so children do not understand folk and fairy tales in the same way that we do. Mm-hmm. And they believe in magic. They believe in they're trying to figure out the good and evil thing. Yeah. And a lot of the more granular concerns that adults have, kids, it just kind of blows right by them. I mean, the violence, like kids, if they watch a violent, you know, if Road Runner runs off the edge of the cliff, you know, like, it's like, okay, but the next scene he's back up.
Yeah.
And they, as they are creating mental images of fairy tales, they have that same kind of bounce back effect.
Yeah.
But they don't fixate on the things that we as adult readers may fixate mm-hmm. on fairy tales. They yeah. hear a good story with lots to engage their imaginations yeah. with this message of resilience.
Yeah. And I'm glad you included that. And I wanted to make sure that I asked you about it because I have shared that concern, even though in my own life, I love fairy tales. And, you know, just not too long ago, I was on kind of a fairy tale book kind of jag. And, you know, I found one, a collection called Tatterhood that I'd never heard of before that was all very strong female characters from all over the world. Yeah, I was like, I know that Stephanie has heard of this one or has it on the shelf behind her, which was cool. But so I had already sort of been, if I'm finding power in these stories, why am I thinking that they would be like, why do I need to hide them from mm-hmm. children? Like I was already kind of there. And so layering in this idea that you've presented here, that they have a really strong potential for contributing to children's resilience was helpful to me. I don't know okay. if that was my little soapbox ramble, but, so I'm thinking through that. I mean, I'm still thinking through that, but,
And I think, I mean, it's like there are thousands and thousands of fairy tales out there from mm-hmm. all over the culture in the world. And yeah. there are like horrible ones.
Yes. Yes.
I wouldn't share. And what we are able to share with young children really is just this tiny cluster mm-hmm. of fairy tales that have been put into picture books, honestly. I mean, most early childhood people that I know don't want to read a book without pictures to yeah. their kids. They don't want to tell the story orally, which is honestly, right. that's where the most powerful storytelling happens yeah. Because kids can construct mental images and everything.
Yeah.
You've got the picture books and they are just, they're a fraction of what folk and fairy tales are all about.
Yeah.
I look for the picture books that I feel are authentic to the meaning of the story, that really have authors who have gone and dug deep uh-huh. and look at, you know, especially like cultural stereotypes and things like mm-hmm. that.
Sure.
That stuff. And, you know, are like, where'd you get this story actually?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how are they represented? And when you take like in a book like Tatterhood, which are really kind of pure, they're told in that very simple, basic fairy tale language.
Yeah.
That's what I think kids need the most, is so that they can engage in their own imagination and put them their yeah. self, like we do when we're reading books.
Yeah. And because we know at the age that, you know, this birth to five age, especially, but I would say even, you know, older than that, they're still so reliant on the concrete. That they are going to connect what you're either reading or telling as a story immediately to their own concrete experience as a human so far. Mm-hmm. And so I guess what I'm saying is there's so much value to providing those things and making them part of children's lives that we can trust, that they're not going to go straight to becoming problematic children who are sexist and ageist and cruel, just because we've told this story. You know what I mean? Just sort of processing as I go, but.
I mean, I think if you look at, I mean, who are the bad guys? And I mean, who are the cruel people in fairy yeah. tales? The bad guys.
Yeah.
They get punished. And yeah. that is
very satisfying for a child.
It was like, I mean, that's, you know, I mean, there's a lot about Kohlberg that I'm not crazy about, but yeah. I think he and Gilligan really did hit on how young children develop an understanding of morality mm-hmm. that really runs parallel to fairy tales.
Yeah.
They're that intentionality and all of those things, very, the birth to five.
Yeah.
Not part of their, not part of the way they're processing.
No.
They want to yeah. know that if you do good, the good stuff happens. And if you do bad, the bad stuff happens
yeah.
because it's their concrete understanding of the world. And I think fairy tales do a better job of that than a lot of modern children's mm-hmm. books.
For sure.
Which tend to focus on intentionality and are really much more ambivalent for mm-hmm. young children.
Yeah.
Which is not maybe not bad, but
yeah. So the other thing that is great about the book is that you've got, you know, like the first half is sort of theoretical, the conversation we're having now. And then you get into individual fairy tales and you talk about how they, not crafts, you know, not like here's how to put this on your lesson plan, but here's how these ideas could be played with from the story. Do you want to, I don't know if you want to talk about a specific fairy tale and kind of, and give some examples or how you want to address that part of the book, but I think it's important that people know that this is also something that you can plug in.
As a lifelong teacher, I mean, you know, like I love theory.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
I'm passionate about that. But honestly, I knew that when I decided that I was going to try to turn my dissertation into a book that real people read, because nobody reads. What I wanted to do was make it something that was practical for teachers. So teachers could say, okay, here's like this my latest newsletter was a Black History Month, and I looked at two different versions of Little Red Riding Hood, one an African American one and one from Africa called Pretty Salma. And to me, those are like, okay, so you read the stories. Kids like them. You read them in group, you read them like individually, whatever you have in the classroom. Kids get interested. So how do you build on that interest? We know that the more kids, more concrete experiences children have, the more they'll play with the ideas, both the social emotional stuff, the resilience stuff, and whatever intrigues them, you know? In their play, and the more they'll start weaving those into their play, and it's through their make-believe and their pretend play that really all of these protective factors for resilience start to take root and grow, I believe. So what do you put in your classroom? What kind of materials can you put in your classroom, in your centers, to inspire, if they're interested, that kind of play? At your writing or your story center, you know, like if you put down, I'm just spitballing here because I didn't write this at all. Put down, like if you put down like red paper or red crayons and brown crayons, if you use like one thing I put in my newsletters, like a lot of baskets. Like we all have baskets in our classroom, but whip them out and put everything in baskets and just put random baskets around your classroom, because that's one of the motifs of the story is doing good with a basket. Salma puts it on her head. Carries eggs, you know, whatever. But ways that putting things in your centers that will maybe make kids connect with them. Maybe there, if you're going to have some kind of materials out for a project, if you do some kind of art project, I'm really big on like collaborative murals because I can't draw.
I need others in on it with me.
Let's all come together and make this thing. That's all I don't have to do.
This will be my corner.
I will be the one who gets the glue.
Exactly.
But helping kids, you know, create, you know, let's do finger painting, and like maybe we can cut those finger paintings that you just did into, you know, I'll help cut them out into forests, and you know, like what else do we need, and those kinds of things that make connections. And I know I've just signed up for your theme class, so
nice.
I'm curious about but I think that as a longtime early childhood person, I gave my kids plenty of time to play whatever they wanted to, but I also offered things that would help them make those connections.
Right.
The story we were reading was something they were interested in. And so though they're in the book, there are lots of different ways that you can tie a story in or materials you can offer, including things. We haven't really hit on the biggie, the self-regulation, which I think is so significant to all kids. All kids need to develop it. For some kids, just because of their temperament, it's going to be easier than others, others' environment. But to me, the idea of self-regulation, we've missed the self part. It's not other regulation. Like, I don't want you to self-regulate because I tell you to, because then it's Stephanie regulating, not self-regulation. I offer a lot of ideas about, you know, when do kids have the hardest time with self-regulation? It's during transitions. It's during those kinds of things. So I try to offer things that were always helpful for me to do with kids, whether it's singing a song related to it or giving them. And I think young children develop their imagination between birth and five. Like that's representation comes online. And we tend to forget that that's the greatest tool in the toolbox is when kids are engaged, you can engage their imagination. That's when you're engaging the part of their brain that is blossoming.
Mm-hmm.
And so I offer a lot of, just ideas that I hope will be springboards for teachers, a lot of movement activities. Mm-hmm. You learn regulation through movement. You learned all of that stuff. And I just tried to put a whole hodgepodge of ideas in there for each of, I think there's six stories in the book with different variants from different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
I thought were interesting. My editor kept telling me to slow down on those. She was like, this is not a book on fairy tales. It's on resilience.
Yeah, but we need the fairy tales.
Anyway, I just tried to make it something that I would have felt found really useful
mm-hmm.
as an early childhood person.
It's a model, right? You have some specific things, but it's also a model for that person who's like, well, I don't know how to come up with things that follow children's interests based on the story we read, or I wouldn't know where to start. So it's a good for those folks who are in that like survival stage and need the specific idea. And then also it's a springboard for those who are kind of consolidating their experience with new information and figuring it all out.
A couple of quick things. One is I taught community college for 20 years and I also was in the field a long time. Uh-huh. So I found people at all different points on their career continuum. Mm-hmm. And I ask for volunteers to read chapters and give me feedback on the.
Oh, great.
A lot of like the whole acknowledgements is just a ton of my former students, ranging from people who are just in the classroom for a year or two to colleagues that have been in for, 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
And saying, tell me how to make this better. What this activity part of it, too much. Some people said way too much information. The people with less experience were like a little bit more.
Oh yeah, sure.
So I tried to kind of hit a balance with that. But the other thing that I haven't really talked about with like the resilience piece is I also offer some ideas about some of the protective factors for resilience that each story, each fairy tale really like hits on.
Yeah.
And examples of things teachers could talk about with kids, how they could get kids, if they had the kids telling stories. I'm a big Vivian Paley person.
Mm-hmm.
Kids were telling and acting out the stories, the kinds of questions they could ask if they felt like this might be useful. And if they got answers that were scary, I actually had mental health professionals give me feedback on like,
that's great.
Early childhood person, would it be okay for me to say, and what should I like mm-hmm. send off to somebody who had much more background in that area?
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I'm glad you included that. And in this conversation, of course, I'm glad you included it in the book, but I'm glad you also brought it into this conversation. So we've got about time to wrap up, but we're going to have another conversation soon. So you mentioned a newsletter. Do you want to tell folks what that is and how to find it if they want it?
There are too many fairy tales and I am not done with this work. I started a little under a year ago, I started a newsletter called Imagination on the Move. And every week it's like a couple of fairy tales and one or more, how it ties into resilience. And then a couple of classroom type connections that you could make or for parents, things they could do with their kids at home, mm-hmm. even. If anybody wants to subscribe to it, you can go to my website, which is just www.imaginationonthemove.com. And you should have a little pop-up thing that will say subscribe here. And if you give me your email address, I'll put you on the list.
Yeah.
And
we'll put the link in the description for the episode too for that. And before I forget, if people want to order the book, they order from Red Leaf Press. If they use the code HER2024, they can get 10% off. through I think the end of April. So hopefully people will go find it. And hopefully a lot of people already have, because I've really enjoyed it. And you know what, if I'm honest, it might not have been something that I would have picked out if I hadn't met you and been convinced that, you know,
you're not the only one.
Well, you know, so I'm so glad. I'm really glad it's out there and that you're here to talk about it and for
Thank
more
you.
Folks. And I don't know, any last things you wanted to include that we haven't touched on?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, I appreciate you giving me the chance to talk with you.
So just thank you for the work. Thank you for this book, and for the continued work on the newsletter. And I know people who go out now and find you are going to be glad they did.
Thank you so much, Heather.
Thanks everybody for listening to another episode of That Early Childhood Nerd.